Fasten your seatbelts and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
Gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, someone bless these seeds I sow. Someone warm them from below till the rain comes.
Today on Route 51, we leave the highway and head to the backyard, and for many, that plot of land turns into an oasis of sensation, sustenance, and serenity. That much-loved and carefully tended patch of dirt will be occupying many of us this Memorial Day weekend and then throughout the summer, where, if we're lucky, the rich humus turned up by a sharp spade will produce seedlings and then tall plants and finally a bounty at harvest time. I'm Rick Ryer of Wisconsin Public Radio, sitting in for Glenn Moberg, who is under the weather today. And for the next hour, we're featuring our annual garden show, just for those of us who live in north central Wisconsin. Joining us today is Paul Jones, co-owner of Land Art in Wausau, and UW Marathon County Professor of Biology and Botany, Paul Whitaker. This is your opportunity to answer your questions asked about all things living in our yards, from the vegetables and flowers you're trying to grow and the shrubs and trees you've planted, to the raspberry, blueberry, and grapevines you've got on the side of the house, to pest control and fertilizer, anything related to growing things in our northern climate. Our lines are open and ready for your call. 800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. And I'd suggest calling early, as this hour will fly by. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook. Just key in Route 51 Show in the search box and send us a note or question while we're on the air. Thank you both for joining us today, both Paul and Paul. I'd like to start with the program with a quote from American writer Lewis Gannett, who said a number of years ago, "Gardening is a kind of disease. It infects you and you cannot escape it. When you go visiting, your eyes rove about the garden. You interrupt the serious cocktail drinking because an irresistible impulse to get up and pull a weed." Does that kind of sum up gardening for both of you?
That's partially true on my part.
I think I'm fatally infected. I've got the garden bug from since I was a kid.
And I've done this for a lot longer than I planned.
You know, I was curious. We've got a freeze warning tonight. Again, believe it or not, last year at this time, we had a snowstorm just before Memorial Weekend. How is that affecting what you're seeing out today and what we'll be seeing in terms of the garden season here in north central Wisconsin?
Well, I'll start off. I subscribe to a newsletter from the State Department of Ag that comes out weekly throughout the growing season, and they report what's called degree days. And degree days is a measure of heat accumulation, and all things that are growing outdoors exposed to the natural temperatures develop according to temperature. And this year we're about two-thirds behind normal and more than twice as far behind last year. Last year was a much warmer year than normal. This year is much colder than normal. And they're reporting that we're about 23 days behind normal for a growing season this year on average across the state.
Well, specific to the freeze aspect of it, what I heard was a temperature anticipated to be at or slightly below 32 degrees, and from a field perspective, not an academic one, my experience has been, well, we have a product in our greenhouse that's called Freeze Proof, and it helps to fortify plants against low temperatures, but and I suspect that a few bottles of that went the other way today, but typically we have not experienced major problems with the plant material that we have until we get to about 26 degrees. And if I were to be concerned about the thousands of perennials we have outside right now, I'd probably turn on the irrigation and let it run overnight. Certainly there's a little bit of concern. If I had some sensitive plants, I'd put a sheet over them or bring them inside, but that's not always possible. I don't think that the ground living plants that have emerged are something that I'd be concerned about. Do you have any gardens going like that, Paul, where you keep track of the results?
No, I don't have any experience with that directly. It's a hard thing to replicate on a year-by-year basis, just with informal observations. The one thing I'm concerned about in my own home garden is my fruit trees, all of which finally are in full bloom. And I'm concerned that the below freezing temperatures may nip a lot of that fruit. I was looking forward to a really good fruit year this year. Usually a late bloom like this protects the plants from frost, but
yeah,
that's just the way the year is going.
Can we catch up on the 23 days we're missing?
there is no catching up on lost sleep or lost weather.
Yeah, I think there's I had heard that a lot of corn growers in the state who had not put their corn in yet were taking their seed back and opting for shorter season varieties. And the shorter season varieties for them have lower yields, but at least it's a yield that will mature in time. So I don't, unless the temperatures suddenly swing up to 90 degrees for the rest of the summer, I think it's going to be a short growing season.
Paul Jones, what are you seeing in terms of, from your business standpoint, landscaping projects more on the homeowner side, or you're looking more towards business, and what kinds of things are you suggesting in planting for this season?
Well, that's a fairly complex question in its entirety. I think it's three parts. Landscape projects for residential consumption are typically driven by the weather. Commercial projects driven by the calendar. We tend to be far more inclined toward residential projects because they're repeat customers, people that we've dealt with over the years, and commercial projects are a little bit, we're unsure of them. They're bid process projects, and so we are not heavily involved in the commercial market at this time of year. Probably it's 10-15% of our business. 80% being customer, direct customer related residential. And the volume of business and the timing has been pretty much predicted by the weather. It was a slow start. On the days that the weather's good, the enthusiasm is high. And even on a cloudy day, you could just feel like the tide's changing. It's very interesting. If that question leads to whether or not we think it's a good year or a bad year, the response would be last year started very early. There was a lot of early enthusiasm, and it was considered a pretty good year. This year, I think, started late, and there was a lot more anxiety built up. But I think that it will be a very good year, and in fact, I feel a growing awareness on the residential side toward doing projects and an enthusiasm for them that is better than last year. Is that what you were asking?
Yes, it was. Thank you. And, Paul, what about new plant varieties coming for gardens, vegetable gardens, that kind of thing at this point?
Is that a Dr. Whitaker question?
Yes, I should have said that. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, let's see. To be honest, this year I have not personally experimented with any really new interesting varieties. I do tend to plant a couple of varieties of all of the different vegetables that I grow and stick with some favorites and always add a couple of new ones into the mix. But I have to admit this year I'm kind of being boring and sticking with the tried and true.
Dick Zondag from Junk Seeds has joined us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Dick.
Good afternoon.
What are you seeing from your company in terms of new varieties of plants, traditional plants such as tomatoes and other vegetables?
There are literally hundreds of varieties of tomatoes out there, and I guess we're seeing the same thing, that the number of new varieties coming out is declining because a lot of the breeding-oriented companies have been purchased by production-oriented companies, and they're discontinuing some of the breeding programs. But there are always new things that come on the market, and so we're always out there trying to find the newest and the best. And I think a lot of the breeding-oriented, the people that are still out there breeding, come to the mail-order companies to introduce new varieties. So, you know, we've always got a sprinkling of the tried and true, but I would say probably in our catalogs, 95% of the products that we sell are things that are tried and true. And, you know, I guess when I'm talking to gardening people, too, I have my list of I guess I call them Dick's picks, you know, that I go through when I'm doing my speeches and stuff. And most of that things are varieties that have been available for, well, 20 to 30 years, because a lot of those things have been tested and retested, and it's becoming, the breeding has been becoming so intense that, you know, I think the production and the sweetness and everything else has reached a point where to find something new, that's got to be really spectacular.
We're talking with Dick Zadig from Jung Seed Company in Randolph, Wisconsin. Paul Whitaker, who is a professor of botany and biology at UW-Marathon County, and Paul Jones, co-owner of LandArt in Wausau. We're taking your calls. If you have any questions regarding your gardens, your shrubs, your plants, vegetables, pesticides, fertilizers, whatever it may be, and with respect to gardening in north central Wisconsin, you can certainly call us today at 800-780-9742. Again, that's 800-780-9742. And we do have a comment on Facebook, a question: any advice on keeping my apple tree from getting wormy without using pesticides?
Well, that's, I'll start with that one. My PhD research project was in an organic apple orchard, and I didn't do a whole lot with the pest management directly. That was managed by the orchard manager, but we were trying to provide perennial flowering plants to feed the good guy bugs that attack the pest insects. And there was some advantage to that, but apples are probably one of the hardest crops anywhere that I'm aware of to grow without pesticides. And if you really want to avoid chemical pesticides on apples, one of the best places to look is, there's a book by a man named Michael Phillips called The Apple Grower. And he's an organic orchardist. He's got a small couple acre orchard in the mountains of New Hampshire. So his climate's similar to ours. The soils are similar to ours. And but it takes a whole book to explain how to grow apples without chemical pesticides.
Yeah, I guess I would agree with that, although there are some apple varieties coming out of some breeding programs that have resistance to apple scab, which is the little black spots that come on the leaves and on the fruit. And, you know, if you want to at least avoid the apple scab, there are probably a half a dozen varieties that I know of that that are resistant to apple scab. So that would at least be a start with the disease problem. The insect problem is a pretty big nut to crack, because there are, you know, multiple pests that love apples, and it's really difficult to grow a blemish-free, insect-free apple without using a regular pesticide program.
Yeah, thinking about how most pesticides work, the insect either eats them and dies, or is exposed to them on their surface and they die. And when you talk about the insects that are inside the apple, you've got a very, very limited window of opportunity in terms of time to target those insects and prevent them from entering the apple. Once they're inside the apple, there's really nothing that you can do. And so timing is everything, and a lot of the non-chemical tools work relatively slowly and have to be applied at just the right time, and that's where you need a whole lot of information. So that book, The Apple Grower by Michael Phillips, I highly recommend that for people that are interested in growing apples without chemical pesticides.
You're listening to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back with your calls right after this.
UMR, a United Healthcare company providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More at umr.com.
And we're taking your calls at 800-780-9742. We're going to go right to the phones now with Ron in Rhinelander. Hi, Ron.
Hello.
What's your question?
I have a hydrangea that's about 8 years old, and it hasn't flowered for the last 4 years. Lots of green foliage. It's kind of like it's getting too much nitrogen, but I don't give it anything. I'm just wondering why it doesn't bloom.
Who'd like to take a stab at that one?
Well, having had thousands of pieces of experience in it, I Paul Jones here talking from LandArt. It's a frustrating thing, and I think that the first thing here in diagnosis is to examine the patient, and in this case, identify it. What kind of hydrangea is it?
It's an Annabelle.
An Annabelle. Not one of the newer rebloomers called Endless Summer?
Nope.
An old Annabelle?
Yep.
How tall has it gotten during the year?
Oh, it probably gets at least 3-4 feet tall.
Well, the simplest, and there's no real good answer without knowing the circumstances, of course, and taking it apart as a case. But we've seen situations where, as Paul Whitaker said earlier, he's concerned about his fruit trees this year because they're in full bloom at a time when we can get a frost.
Sure.
It's possible that the hydrangea has succumbed to a healthy condition under good protective snow and then has gotten bad weather when it's tried to erupt. We've had it happen with many, many customers. Primarily, what I think I've found, and this is a pretty vague answer, and I apologize for it, but it covers tens of thousands of circumstances. Sometimes we find the plant material just isn't real hardy for the zone. And it's either bad weather timing or something like that. Do you have any other hydrangeas on the property that are performing well, or are there any other flowering plants that are performing poorly?
No, this is the only hydrangea, and everything else seems to be doing, you know, well.
And you've had it, you said, for 8 years?
Yeah, about that, 7-8 years, something like that. And, you know, it gets a good half day of sun. It does, you know, it's in the shade for a part of the day, but it's not deep shade. I'm thinking it's getting enough light, and I'm just wondering if, you know, we provide phosphorus for some of our annuals to get them to bloom. Is that worth a try?
Well, you know, I suspect I would choose an organic remediation for that. The product that I would suggest that you try may be not known to you as yet. It's called Super Thrive.
Okay.
The directions for its use are rather complex. I shouldn't say complex, but a little bit confusing in that it's a very busily written instruction book. But Superthrive, which can be bought online, and it is just a miracle ingredient. We'll call it more like a vitamin for plants.
Okay.
And if that plant is going to bloom, it'll bloom with Super Thrive. I would suggest, though, that these plants are primarily victims of the conditions that they live in. And if you found that you dug a hole next to this hydrangea and filled it with water and it didn't drain within 4 or 5 hours, you may have a condition that is stifling the plant outside of above-ground weather. Think of that plant as one with the soil that it's in, not a plant stuck in soil. We now think of plants and soil as one ecosystem. And make sure that it's well-drained enough, and that plant should like organic
sandy
material.
Loam. I think it's fine.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's kind of a tough thing to take apart, and if there was an easy answer, I would throw it out there. But I don't think that it's real smart to do that without a whole lot of evidence. But
okay.
Do try something like Super Thrive on it and do it with a couple of your other plants. I think that you'll have found a product that you really enjoy. If the plant can be successful, this will assist it greatly.
We'll give it a try.
Good luck.
Ron, thanks for your call. 800-780-9742 if you'd like to have your gardening question or planting questions answered by our three experts here today. Dick Zondag, I had a question regarding heirloom vegetables, and heirloom vegetables have gotten very popular over the years. Are there any inherent advantages or disadvantages of heirloom varieties?
Heirlooms versus hybrids is one of the subjects that I cover when I talk. Heirlooms tend to have a wider diversity as far as genetic material. So if one plant, for instance, gets a disease, not all of the plants will necessarily get a disease, where if you've got a hybrid plant, if one is affected, they're all going to be affected. Another advantage or disadvantage of hybrids versus open pollinates. For instance, with broccoli, if you're planting a hybrid broccoli, they're all going to be ready at the same time. Or if you plant an open pollinated variety of broccoli, you may be able to harvest plants over a 2 to 3 week period. So I think the nice thing about heirloom seeds is that you get a more diverse genetic background, because the way that heirloom seed is produced is they plant the seed out and they make no attempt to control, other than isolation, the pollen that makes the seed. Where with a hybrid, the two parents are very closely controlled, so the genetic material of one of a hybrid seed will be almost exactly the same from one seed to the next. So it can be an advantage or a disadvantage. You know, with hybrid seeds, you're probably going to get larger fruit, sweeter fruit. And usually with hybrid seeds, they're more targeted as to what you can use that particular variety for. For instance, with hybrid cucumbers, you have to read the description, because a variety that's a hybrid that's great for fresh eating may not be a very good pickle for pickling, and vice versa. One that's been bred for pickling may not be a good variety for fresh eating. So you've got to be sure you read the description, where open pollinated varieties tend to be more dual use type thing. So that's basically how. And the other thing about heirlooms is they've been bred and selected and selected so many times that you know, they've got a pretty good background. For instance, one of the tomatoes that we have in our catalog, the Way Ahead tomato, when we had our centennial back six or seven years ago, we went back into the old catalogs and found that variety had been in the catalog since 1920. And so, you know, each year you go out into the field and you pick out the stock plants that look the most like a Way Ahead tomato, and that's the seed that you use for next year's seed field. And so each year you're selecting so that you know, the characteristics of that tomato are improved. So there are pluses and minuses with both heirlooms and hybrids.
Terrific. Thank you very much for that great explanation. We'll be coming back to the program in just a few minutes after we take a news break from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening to Route 51. You can call us at 800-780-9742. Annual gardening show on Route 51 from Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Rick Ryer in for Glenn Milberg. With me today is Paul Whitaker, Associate Professor of Biology and Botany at UW-Marathon County, Paul Jones, co-owner of LandArt in Wausau, and Dick Zondag, who is the president of J.W. Jung Seed Company in Randolph, Wisconsin. Thanks again for joining us today, gentlemen. What are the biggest mistakes, Paul Whitaker, people make while they're planting tomatoes, peppers, summer squash, winter squash, and so on?
Well, I would say two big mistakes. The first one, if you're starting a brand new garden, is to not start with a soil test. As Paul Jones was talking about earlier, we like to think about plants and soil as one, and at least half of a plant is below ground, and we forget about that. So taking care of that environment is at least as important as taking care of the above-ground environment. So I really like people to start with a soil test. find out what their soil needs in terms of changing the pH, any nutrients that might be needed, organic material, those kinds of things. And then beginning gardeners often just start off too big. Gardens can really be overwhelming, particularly keeping up with the weeds. It's one thing to till up a bare patch of soil in the springtime and throw a bunch of plants in, but that's fun. The weeding part can be really tedious, and people get in over their heads, and then they look at it, shake their heads in frustration, and just stop.
And give up.
Yeah. And then as the intro song to this second half started out, I was curious what the fifth thing was, water, soil, sun, and space, and I didn't catch the fifth because you faded out.
Air,
okay. So space, I had a college roommate who bought his first house after graduating college. He and his wife went out and bought, I think, 25 tomato plants, and they had dug up a space about 3 feet by 10 feet, and they planted them all. So spacing is really quite an issue.
Paul Jones, a question regarding landscape around the house especially. As somebody's preparing to put in a rock area around the home and put in some plantings, what specific kind of grading specifications or detail do they need to know?
Well, the residential code is a 3% grade 10 feet from the house.
Mm-hmm.
So we want all surface water moving away from the house. And then the position of the house on the overall gradient, look uphill as far as you can, and then picture how much water is running down toward your house and determine whether or not if a diversionary way has to be cut, a swale or something. considering that there are both the surface water, normal surface water, normal percolation, and soil conductivity during the growing season, there's also the concern of what happens when the ground is frozen. And I think some experience in engineering should be applied to that. And then, of course, you have subsurface water conditions. And if I could name a specific example, I would certainly use that land around Rib Mountain, because there are many pieces of soil there that we have perching clay soils all over this county that just exude water all times of the year. So that type of control is the first consideration. When we think about planting, we think about taking a plant and putting into the soil pocket that we want it to fit in, and that doesn't always work. So projects should start with good engineering and good water management plans.
Paul Whitaker, you were talking about getting soil tests, and I should remind listeners you can join us as well by calling 800-780-9742. Join us on the air with your questions about gardening in north central Wisconsin, 800-780-9742. And Paul, you were mentioning that would be the first thing that you would suggest for somebody that's new to gardening, especially to get a soil test. And once that test is done and you find out what your soil needs, and going to Dick Zondag right now, how does somebody incorporate, or how should they incorporate any additives or minerals into the soil?
Well, in my own garden, what I did when I first started working in the garden, when I was just a graduate out of college, I lived in the same house that my parents started, and we used to rake everything in a big pile and burn it, and that was way back in the 60s, And so the first thing I did was I got a load of mushroom compost. I think the following organic, a lot of the organic ways where you're taking your leaves and your grass clippings and adding your fertilizer to the compost pile in the fall and then letting that work over the winter, and the microorganisms that do the decomposition, that remove the cellulose from the leaves or decompose it, turn those chemical fertilizers into organics, and then when you're adding that to the garden, it really gives you both a better soil texture and better nutrient holding capacity and better water holding capacity. And I agree with the guest that said to get a soil sample done. But then after you've got the garden at the right pH and the right nutrient levels, then by using good organic methods of adding compost or using well-rotted manure and things like that. I tell people to watch the color of the plants, because if the plants are a nice dark green and they're not overgrowing or undergrowing, by following those organic methods, your plants will be in heaven, actually. And if the color is right, additional soil tests aren't necessary. So, you know, and the other thing that I like to teach new gardeners is to keep a notebook, you know, on when you planted things or when you started things and what varieties you use, because a lot of people will take a seed packet and they'll put a stake on the end of the garden and they'll put the seed packet on to keep track of the varieties that they're using, and then over the summertime the seed packet blows away and then they'll scratch their head wondering what variety of vegetable or what they used. And they'll have to start over again, where if you keep track of the of what you use. In fact, on our website, we have a new software that's a, you know, the best garden planner. We didn't write the software. We're kind of an intermediary, but it keeps track of what you planted where and for years and years, and helps you plan the amount of space and what you planted and what, you know, the rotation, so that you're not planting tomatoes where you planted tomatoes last year. And by using a notebook and or this website, you can really learn and start out the right size and start out with the easy to plant vegetables and then go into some of the harder ones later on when you get a little more experience.
Paul Whitaker, how has the recent, meaning in the past 3 to 4 years, 3 to 5 years, focus on sustainability affected the way you teach your courses here at the university? And the whole movement on the homegrown movement that's going on right now with the family farms, with community gardens, and farmers markets. How has that affected how you taught your courses?
Well, 3 years ago, I started teaching a course called Scientific and Social Aspects of Organic Agriculture with a rural sociologist here on campus, Kat Becker. She and her husband operate Stony Acres Farms out in Athens. And so that's a whole new course that we're offering with sort of an emphasis on organics and sustainability. And it's really interesting to us. I guess I've always been kind of a foodie, even as a kid. I dug my first vegetable garden, or I tried to. I was too small to actually get the spade into the lawn. So I'd have my bigger brother help me dig my first garden when I was too little to shove a spade into the soil. So I've always been interested in food and gardening and growing food and cooking, too. And it's interesting in this organics class how little our students know about where their food comes from. And you know, we try to differentiate, you know, why would a farmer choose to grow organic? Why would a consumer choose to purchase organic? Why would they pay more? Why would a farmer do more work that's required to grow organically? And what's even more interesting to us, I think, is how little students know about where their food comes from, period. So unfortunately, my botany course that I teach spring semester, especially years like this year, there's nothing that we can do outside in terms of, you know, I would love to have a school garden here on campus or close by, but the timing of the courses that I offer and the outdoors, the weather, they don't jibe.
Question regarding butternut squash. We have a couple of plants that have been planted from seed over the early spring, late winter, and they're growing in these little Cool Whip containers right now. Don't have much of a space to put them in the ground. Somebody has told us that we could put them in the ground and then have them rise up on a trellis. Is that a wise idea with a big squash like that?
If you do decide to do that, what you'd have to do is support the fruit somewhat, because the weight of the fruit is going to tear the vine right off the trellis if you don't. And just a simple sort of a netting around the fruit, and then just tying it to maybe putting a wire across the whatever you have your trellis supported on to help support the weight of the fruit would help that. Usually trellising squash, especially the bigger squash, is a pretty, it's not the best way to do it. For small gardens, if you wanted to put squash that get bigger, there are varieties that only get, well, they're called bush varieties. They only get like a 36-inch vine, and then they don't take over your garden, basically. So, you know, if that's probably what I would do. I'd recommend a different variety that doesn't vine, and that way, you know, you're not taking up your whole garden for one vegetable.
We're talking gardening here at Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join us by calling 800-780-9742. We'll be back right after this.
PR comes from Northwind Renewable Energy, Stevens Point, proud to partner with Focus on Energy in converting the sun's energy into green electricity with photovoltaic systems for business and agriculture. Learn more at northwindre.com.
1-800-780-9742. Join us with your gardening questions. Paul Jones, a question about roses. It's kind of tough to grow roses in north central Wisconsin. Do you have suggestions regarding specific varieties that people should be looking at?
Well, the nearly wild roses, which I think is the right term to use to lead people into this subject, developed, and I think North Dakota, are so hardy that the Dakotas had a problem eradicating them. So it would seem that roses are hard to grow here, but I have not necessarily found that to be true. Paying attention to the weather, of course, I wonder if it isn't easier to grow roses here on a more limited calendar than it is to grow them where you have consistent high humidity conditions and more fungal problems. There are some varieties, as there are in all plant materials. We would say it's aggressive to try a new variety until it's been proven. We've had trouble with some of the red, bright red roses in the past couple of years, but there are many varieties that grow well. As a matter of fact, in one of the more difficult streetscapes that I've done in the past decade, we could mention River Valley State Bank headquarters. I don't think that's overly commercial. They're on North 17th Avenue in Wausau, and rather than for them to have a precast retaining wall, we suggested a rock garden into which we planted pink pavement roses, which have no irrigation and no real good nutrient. And of the 117 plants, we have lost zero. I interspersed a couple reds as a color blend. Oh, if a person wants rose color, I think that we're back to the issue of good soil preparation. We haven't talked about microbial consortia. That's an area of Paul's expertise. We enter into that, and a whole different level of discussion comes, because these plants are only healthy when the microbes are alive and thriving in the soil. But I don't consider roses. Roses are a challenge as to variety, but if you want roses, you should have them.
Good answer. Let's go to Kim from Boulder Junction.
Yes.
Hi, Kim.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, and I have to tell you, it's so wonderful to have a garden show on at this time of day. Okay, so my question is, I have peonies. I have about 12 of them. I have a very sunny piece of property. I transplanted 8 of these peonies about 8 years ago, and they have yet to bloom. What did I do to my peonies?
Did you plant them deep enough?
I will venture a guess. Peonies need to be planted quite shallow, you know, so there's only about 2 inches of soil between the top, between the eyes and the surface. So if you planted them too deep, that can affect the flowering. Of course, you said it was in full sun, because shade can affect peonies, and they like to have pretty neutral pH. So if your soil is either too sweet or too sour, that can also affect the flowering. But the depth is of the peonies is usually the biggest problem with flowering.
Okay, I did, when I transplanted them, I believe I put them in where it was real sandy.
Okay.
And now I've taken them back to the original location. Will I ever get them back flowering, do you think, since they've
peonies,
been dormant this long?
Yeah, if they're in a situation where they're happy, they'll flower.
Okay, that's good. Well, we want them happy. The other thing is, in our garden, We have about a 6-foot, very strong fence that we grow our spaghetti squash on, and we've done that the last 2 years, and I'll tell you, it's just been wonderful because they just grow up, and the heavy fruit does stay on, so I don't know. It worked for us. Just wanted to pass that along.
What's a spaghetti squash?
Pardon me?
What's a spaghetti squash?
How would we describe it? It's a white squash. It looks kind of like they can get up to about the size of a small football. And when you bake them, you pull them out with a fork, and the pulp is consistent of spaghetti.
Yeah. And they're very, it's a very sweet squash.
Yes.
And the fruits store very well, too.
Yes.
So it's a great all-around squash.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kim.
Bye-bye.
Spaghetti squash. I'm really getting hungry now.
Well, and you actually, we've used it just like spaghetti, where we've used a tomato sauce on it, and actually, it's really good that way.
Sorry about that. Are you there, Dick?
Yes, I am. I'm still here.
Okay. We're going to go to Jack from Interstate 94. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Had a question for the panel.
Go ahead.
Could somebody tell me what their opinions are on the hanging fruit, the upside-down fruits? I'm thinking particularly tomatoes. You see them advertised everywhere. I think you see strawberries advertised that way also. Just wondering what they feel about them. I know they're novelties, but are they worth looking into or not?
We sell a lot of those topsy-turvies, I think is what you're talking about. And a couple of cautions on topsy-turvies. Don't use the heavy, large tomatoes because they become very heavy because you use an organic soil in it, and if you overwater, those planters can weigh 50, 60 pounds, and if you just put them in a 2x4, you know, you'll break the 2x4, but they work amazingly well. At least that's been my experience.
800-780-9742. You can join us by calling 800-780-9742. Question came up about fertilizers and herbicides for lawns. Are there any of those items that are safe for families and pets and waterways? Paul Whitaker?
Well, we did a couple of showings of a film called Chemical Reaction this spring here in Wausau, and I gave a little how-to talk on low-chemical lawn maintenance after that. There's really three chemicals that people will use on their lawns. One is obviously a fertilizer, and those are really not harmful to people. So apply the appropriate rate. You'll get a nice, lush, green lawn. The second thing that's commonly added to lawns is insecticides. And the data that I've seen and reports that I've heard from people around this area that know about these things is that you might only need an insecticide in a lawn in north central Wisconsin maybe 1 year out of 10. So grubs tend to be very uncommon in this area, at least to the degree that they're causing harm to the lawn. So insecticides typically aren't recommended. They're used frequently, but they're not needed that often. And then the third thing that's added is herbicides. And the herbicides kill all of the plants other than the turf grass, dandelions and creeping Charlie and crabgrass and the other types of things. And that's the one that the insecticides and the herbicides are things that people will have health concerns about. There are some tools that you can use, but to get away from the chemical herbicides in lawns, but none of them are as effective, none of them work as quickly, none of them work as long, and again, it's kind of like the apple question that we had in the first half hour. It takes a lot of information to be able to have a relatively weed-free lawn without chemical herbicides. One product that you could look at that inhibits the germination of seeds, so it won't do anything for established weeds in your lawn, but it will prevent new weeds from germinating, is corn gluten meal. That's one that you can take a look at. In general, the recommendations that we had were to keep the lawn well irrigated, to aerate it so that the root system has access to oxygen below ground, to do a soil test and get the pH to the optimum level for the turf grass, and then increase your mowing height. And all of those things will increase the vigor of the turf grass so that the turf can outcompete the weeds. And then the other things will kind of tip the balance.
Yeah, Paul Jones will insert something here on Dr. Whitaker's comment, and that is that that I consider one of the most dangerous things that we do to our plants is salt. And the synthetics contain urea, the source of nitrogen, a lot of salt, and we're constantly trying to break the bond, the ion bond between the salt molecule and the soil down, and we have a way of doing that to allow the salt to leach out of the soil so that the plant roots have a more vigorous place to grow and the microbial cultures can become active. Nothing will break down a long hydrocarbon chain product better than a complex microbial complex in the soil. So I think the people that are concerned about the health and well-being of people around these chemicals also have to remember that their life in the soil is greatly determined by the soil's ability to break them down. So using organics is much more important, I think, than commercially we've been made aware yet. As a company, we've been working on it for 30 years.
And we'll have to leave it at that. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Today's guest, Paul Jones, co-owner of Land Art in Wausau. Dick Sontag, president of the J.W. Jung Seed Company in Randolph, Wisconsin, and UW-Marathon County Associate Professor of Biology and Botany, Paul Whitaker. I'm Rick Ryer of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to Glenn Moberg for producing today's program. Our on-air producer, Jake Claudi, promotions director, Jane Ritger, and special music today by John Denver and Michael Kindergarten. Next week, we head over to the water in search of the mysterious muskie. Route 51 can be heard every Thursday at 5 on the Ideas Network stations, WLBL 91.9 FM, Wausau 930 AM, Auburndale Stevens Point 90.3 FM, WHBM in Park Falls, WHAA 89.1 FM, Adams, Wisconsin Rapids, and WHRM 90.9 FM, High Definition Channel 3. Thanks again for riding along with us today, and until next week, we're heading out of town.